Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Emily Moan Slate. Emily Moan Slate is an MFA graduate of the Bennington Writing Seminars and teaches first year writing at Carnegie Mellon University. Her poems have appeared in The Fourth River, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Pittsburgh City Paper, and Voices from the Attic, and are forthcoming in the Indiana Review and the Motif Volume 4 anthology. She was runner-up for the 2014 Indiana Review Poetry Prize and runner-up for Free State Review's 2014 John Ellsberg Poetry Contest. Hi, Emily. How are you?
Hi, Jan. I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. Congratulations on your runner-up prizes.
Thank you.
That's great. I mean, that the Indiana Review is a great one.
Yeah, it's exciting. That's the first kind of national publication. So that's, yeah, I'm excited about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you have a manuscript called The Dress Preserver, and you're going to read from that?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll start with a few older poems. The Dress Preserver. I labored to open the cardboard coffin, sheathed as it was in layers of tape. The dress preserver had taken more precautions than necessary, as the undertaker seals the coffin just so, certain it is inviolable before cradling its heft into dark earth. No dirt, air, or touch could sully its pristine whiteness. Like Waterhouse's Ophelia, it lay alone in repose, vacant, the wedding dance a mere watery dream. I cannot remember when the branch cracked and it slipped into the river. When I finally exhumed the dress, shaped to the contours of my younger body in love, I fell to my knees and howled. The chiffon bodice felt like what they nestled my pappy in at his funeral. It never occurred to me on that wedding day how funereal its billowing seams were, or that it was possible I might exhume it alone from a dark basement beneath an apartment in which you will never live. Your blade. My cart glides into the frozen foods aisle, and there you are, unloading bags of frozen peas, ripping apart the box with your blade. You look good, you say. I return the compliment and wish I didn't mean it. We laugh about the time you slipped and fell, trying to moonwalk on our kitchen floor. I forgot how laughing with you is harder than anything now. I push my cart away and after a few seconds look over my shoulder. Your back is foreign. I wonder if anyone has touched it since you left. Spin the bottle. Guys should watch out for me. I always break up with them. Except Sean Vox in eighth grade. I was sure he'd be my first kiss, so I practiced making my thin lips supple. The day after he asked me out, Carla Kelly asked him to a party. He kissed every girl there, some maybe twice. I grew my heart a stiff collar around its beating parts and looked down from that perch. He picked daisies from his mother's garden, laid them in my locker, tied with light blue ribbon and a letter. I let them rot. My eyes followed the back of his head all year. Todd Stewart kissed my lips the next year instead, crisp at first, like those shirts he tucks so tightly, then a blind tongue darting. Just after my husband left for good, I saw Sean Vox. I talked to him for the first time in 15 years, and stared at his lips on his beer. And then a few years later, I fell in love again. Thunderstart, Pirates Bay, Tobago. We're in the sea when the rain comes hard. He runs to shore, his legs slick and purposeful, to build a canopy of umbrellas over our bags on a cracked plastic chair. When he's done, he stands and watches to make sure it doesn't fall. I didn't ask him to do this, to build a thin roof over our things. I'm afraid I'll get used to this kind of kindness. From somewhere up in the leaves, thunder starts sounding. The guidebook said tourists who swim in this secret bay could be attacked or robbed. I worry in the warm jade water while he swims unhurried, smiling with a light like Leander's, low thunder threatening to snuff it out. I wait on my side of the bay for him to reach me and float on my back, open my mouth to the rain, a blue-green body tapped by water from southern clouds. Try to soak in this hidden water rather than the wavering architecture of his hands. So I spent half of last year living in India and Qatar. I was co-leader of a study abroad service learning trip with about 10 college students, and these next few poems come out of those experiences. I go to Benares with Raghu Rai. This poem has an epigraph. False and impenetrable, like a garden traced on a mirror, Jorge Luis Borges. A man sits on a stone wall, knees tucked, burnt orange dab coloring his tunic incompletely, eyes hollow, his hands like dead fish hung on his thighs. He is watching the skiffs stuck on the Ganges, six people standing in each. He can't see the shadowed space between hut and temple, where the figure like a scarecrow stands, head, arms, and a body, no face. A woman reaches over the boat's rim for a floating candle flower. Another woman rises from the river, dripping a copper pot balanced in one hand. The snow tiger of painted stone poses behind four fruit sellers, jaws fixed open. Bracelets are laid out one by one. Little sons, they want to circle your hand. I can't tell where the man ends and the cow begins. Burning bones and hair tang sticks in my eyes. The body cinders black, its 2 feet sticking out of white smoke. What does it matter that I touch this river, these faces, these hot feet?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Emily Mone Slate, and she's reading from her new manuscript, The Dress Preserver. Emily, I love your precise language and how you always, though, get to some emotional material in your poems. And there's such great humanity in your work.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think that's hard to do. Can you talk about your process of writing in relation to that? Is that a goal of yours to get to that emotion?
Yes. I find poetry that doesn't have that kind of dead. I think I try to have that in absolutely every poem, even though it's different. And I think that is usually the driving mechanism for me. So in terms of process, a poem for me starts with a spark of emotion, whether that's deep sadness or anger. Sometimes it's an idea that I have, but it always connects to an emotion. And the process, I feel like, of writing a poem for me comes from getting as close as I can to saying it, to conveying it as kind of clearly for the reader as possible. So sometimes it'll come out really muddled at first, and I have to kind of work at it and peel away the layers.
Okay. I'm thinking of a line from your poem, Spin the Bottle. I grew my heart a stiff collar. I mean, you have some just terrific language and surprising details. And I'm imagining those come in revision. I don't know if that's true.
Yes, that one in particular came in revision. The poem first came from a narrative. And then going back and really trying to get in touch with that emotion, I tried to connect it to an image. And that one just came. Sometimes, I have to sweat over them.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, actually, often I sweat over them. But sometimes the poetry gods just kind of like visit one upon you. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what happened with that one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So are you a big reviser?
Yes. Oh, God, yes. There's very few poems that kind of, come out the way that they end up. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to ever say that a poem is done. There's maybe a couple poems that I've written that feel done-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you might revise 10, 20,
yes,
40 times?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you read some more?
Sure. So this poem starts with a bit of Hindi, and it's the first in a longer series called Letters to Pittsburgh. Letters to Pittsburgh, 1, Carol Bog, Delhi. Larki Dor Rahi Hai, the one sentence my students remember in Hindi. The girl is running. She is running. She is 5. Her legs are small. The men do what they want with her. She cries out. They cut her throat. She quiets. A floor below her parents. The men staunch the blood with candles. I know kind men, loving men. Cab driver brushes my leg. You married? Any kids? Dark birds glide over the Jama Masjid. I used to think they rode the air for some beautiful purpose. Wings trail shadows on red tiles. The circling a calculation. A means to strike cleaner. To control. I pull my skin closer. They can't see my face. What can it mean to pray now? So we traveled to India just weeks before the 2012 gang rape on the Delhi bus. And while we were there, we regularly confronted cases of sexual violence in the news, and 8 out of the 10 students were young women. To be a woman. To be a woman means you aren't really supposed to trust any men. When your husband leaves the car to buy some water and the driver hits the pedal, you yell, "Not yet, go back." He says, "I'm just turning around, ma'am. Ma'am, please." You feel like an ass. But you were thinking of the Swiss woman gang raped in the woods, of the woman on the bus raped by 7 men and a metal rod, of the girl in your math class, of the 5-year-old alone for 2 days in an apartment below her parents. At the gym, you watch a mango juice commercial, starring role, sex repressed. 2 women with movie star hair jockey to pour mango juice down one man's throat. Crouched, barely clothed, in a green glade, skin glistening, beyond delighted. This next poem was inspired by the practice of falconers or falcon hunters in the UAE, flying on airplanes with their falcons, and they actually have to buy a ticket for their falcon to ride, which is not cheap. The falcon next to me on Qatar Airways flight 835 shifts his wings under his seatbelt, unaccustomed to others' wings, and asks me when the light will go off. I try to be friendly, make small talk, but I'm scared to fly, and his pointed face disapproves of each word. His white eye flickers. Where is he from? Mongolia. Part peregrine, part soccer. Happy he's out of his hack pen, heading somewhere new, even if it means hunting for a new sheikh. He leans forward to extract the airplane magazine with his feet, talons riffling glossy paper. I twitch. He says reading is hard, but only because he sees too much. Dust swirls, fingerprints. His talon brushes my arm, and we both pull away, embarrassed. Lights dim and his eyes brighten as he reads about Nepal, a place he'd like to go someday, eyes searing pulp dry, searching for meaning beyond small prey, his body free and rustling now in his aisle seat. This one's kind of an anti-travel poem. What it's come to. Before we left the Delhi Radisson, I took the Twinings teas from the plastic tray, tucked them into my backpack, called the front desk for more toilet paper, pulled out cardboard circles to pack paper between my shirts, shoved the tiny sewing kit into a shoe. Living from room to room as a tourist in a country where you stick out means feeling like an aging rock star. You get recognized, but only in a vague sort of way. I'm tired of this. I don't want to rise above the petty, Don't want to say yes to another person asking for a picture. Don't want near death by car, cow, rickshaw. Don't want to remember another room number, which way to jiggle the lock, which way for hot water that's lukewarm at best. Maybe I've stayed too long. The turbans, the bright saris, the painted trucks are starting to look like the skinny jeans, the coach bags, the Pontiac Bonnevilles. 3 beds in 2 days, diarrhea and a sore throat. It's come to this. Me in a flooded bathroom in Hotel Le Golden, crying. Chants from the Golden Temple filtering through the stained screen.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty. And my guest today is the poet Emily Moan Slate, reading some poems from her manuscript, The Dress Preserver. Could you say again that what kind of trip you were making with your students?
So we called it the social change semester. My husband and I took a group of 10 undergrads to India and Qatar to study and also do service work.
Mm-hmm. And how long was that trip?
For 4 months, for a whole semester.
That's a long time.
It was an intense experience. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in writing poems from that experience, did you notice anything different about your process in writing, or did you feel compelled to, for example, use real details, et cetera?
Yes, yes. I was nervous about traveling and trying to write kind of from an authentic place because, you know, I'm a girl from Pittsburgh and I, you know, tend to try to write things that I know. And so to go to places that are really far away and write kind of as a Western, you know, tourist, even though we were there doing work, we were still tourists. It was tricky. And I was really aware of that kind of position the whole time. Mm-hmm. But I was working with Mark Wunderlich in my program at Bennington. And, you know, I kind of said to him, how can I write good poems from this experience? And he said, stay with the details. And stay in your own experience, because even though you're there, you're still writing kind of through your own two eyes. And that was really good advice.
Mm-hmm. I thought the poem about the rape poem was really powerful.
Thank you.
And that especially seems like a challenging poem to write.
Yes. Yeah, that I would say that's one of the most emotional poems, kind of heavily emotional poems that I have written, and it was hard to write because of that, because sometimes when you have so much emotion on a subject, the poem just ends up being terrible. Mm-hmm. And you have to really, I think that one I really labored over to try to give it some structure so that it could stand on its own still.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic in a way that, I mean, I think it's a great poem, but ironic in a way that a lot of poems about trauma, tragedies, hard to write, tend to be overwritten, and people say too much because they want to make sure that it's said.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to pull back, I think, mm-hmm. and have restraint in those poems because they're loaded with emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you did a great job on that. So do you have more Qatar poems or no? You
I have some, but I brought some other ones as well that
okay,
I've been working
we'll read
on.
Read whatever you want. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the last couple kind of deal with the body and identity. So this one is about Caryatid, a Greek sculpture of a woman's body that literally serves as a pillar for a structure. Woman as column, Fitzwilliam Museum. What made her particular is lost. She towers above the room with empty eyes and sunken stone hair. The temple roof she once balanced has vanished from her hard head. The professor found her buried in a dung heap up to her neck. Her people had planted her deep to help grow their crops. He worked hard to get at her. Before he wrenched her out, he bribed the Turks in charge, traded a telescope for her generous body. She's in the Fitzwilliam now, off a cobbled Cambridge street, priestess of Demeter's cult, holding a crumbled cista packed with secrets. I can see the woman who posed for this stone's curves, stock still, her bleak lips shut. Tonight she stands without light among mouthless strangers and water pitchers, an old Gorgon head between her breasts, her only working eyes. Confessions of a CSP. After my husband notices me doing it again, I Google how to stop picking skin off your fingers and learn it's a real thing, dermatillomania or compulsive skin picking, CSP. They say people do it for lots of reasons, anxiety, OCD, ADD, the comfort of smoothing an edge. In 33 years, I've never reached skin fully smooth, not even after the women at Angel Nails tisk at my cuticles and we bond through our imperfections. And that's why I have to keep doing it, trying for perfection, which I know philosophically is possible. An online message board offers wisdom. If you can become aware of what makes you want to pick, you can overcome it. People's posts make me sick, embarrassed to struggle with something so small. But I like this place where people get that hangnails are urgent. I want to tell them about the film Black Swan, how it haunts me when Natalie Portman pulls a piece of skin entirely down one of her fingers, then her hand. I had to close my eyes, the violence too close to my own need. And of course, that's when the audience realizes she's crazy. I learn in grotesque testimonials that some people pick their face, their neck, their palms, their toes, their lips. I feel more normal. I start to pick my left thumb. Someone writes, I've noticed I do it less by doing yoga more. There's always someone who counts on the Buddha. My favorite person on the message board, Song of Mercy, writes only this, I'm all better now. I started smoking.
I love that you put in that Natalie Portman reference because it took me right back to that scene in the movie, and I have never talked to anyone about that. I'm glad that you're talking about it. It was so effective.
Yes, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually did cover my eyes in that scene.
It felt real. It made the movie feel more real. I mean, that movie felt real.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. Okay. Thanks. Sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay.
Yeah. Can you read some more?
Sure. American Girl. I watch you balance cup and saucer on your doll's hard lap, holding her legs down with one hand, pushing her chest back with the other. You don't see your power. You revel in reading to the plastic child who can't hear, telling secrets to one who can't speak. There's nothing wrong with taking care of babies. It's the work of ages. But her blank eyes fix out of range, fingers can't grasp, lips just gloss polyester guts. I've seen you headlock your brothers, dance naked and yelling on the dinner table. You're already the girl others follow without knowing why. You swish hips, slice cartwheels so fine they wilt cheerleader hair. How do I say it? What you do may become what you keep doing. Who you are now may become who others prefer you to be. Let me try again. Don't love their dead rosebud lips. Don't want their cool, unbending arms. Most anything. Baby Center update, February 20th. You may be able to see her squirm under your clothes. Other news. 12 illegal miners hauled up from an abandoned gold mine, hundreds more decomposing underground. A 25-year-old woman hacked to death with a meat cleaver in Delhi, walking to meet her cousin's new baby. A plane missing over Nepal, over the mountains where we ate mango on twin beds pushed together, unsealable crack between bony mattresses, and talked about babies, how maybe we were ready. How is it that we are this fragile, this prone to be cleaved, swallowed, scissored from sky, to have no idea what the hell we're doing until we've done it, when of course we can rationalize most anything? I will forget these stories, write new ones as if they are true.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Emily Mountslate. You have, you know, in this short group of poems. You have a number of poems with some heavy stuff in them, and I wanted to ask about your choice or mm-hmm. your, I don't know if it's a, if you look at it as a choice or as mm-hmm. something you're driven to do as a poet, to reach out and talk about other places, trauma in other places of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about that?
Yes, that's a great question. I do find, we were talking about emotion earlier, and I do find that I feel a lot of emotion, especially surrounding women's stories. The poets who've really affected me, who I feel like kind of ushered me into poetry in the library, you know, in high school, were women poets. And for me, they allowed me a voice and allowed me to feel like my experiences and the experiences of other women could be told in poetry. And so, you know, it's kind of a two-pronged thing. It's like, I feel inspired to tell those stories, but I also feel a call to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's something I'll continue to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you're doing it.
Thanks.
Okay. We have time for one or two more.
Okay. So even when you go far away, when you're a Pittsburgher, Pittsburgh is always kind of with you. Breakfast on the roof of a cheap hotel, McLeod Gunge, Dharamsala. From a dying cedar rises one great spindly branch, a crazy updo, prayer flags knotted around its body. I love to look at it. It is beautiful because it is not beautiful. Past the cedar, you can see what we call Cloud Lake, a lake we think exists but may only be clouds. I eat yogurt, honey, and papaya and watch snow lift off a mountain, white rising into air. We do not agree on a definition of mountain, too imprecise, not unlike love or the past. In Pittsburgh, we have hills we call mountains. Carol says she won't cross them. She might get swallowed up into some great mouth. A river can be a mountain too. Across the street, three kids sit in a window, watching a wedding. They perch so lightly, lightly as birds. When you're pregnant, which I just was, I just had a baby, people love to give you advice. Elliptical advice. This poem is after Harriet Mullen. Sleep now because soon, what no one tells you is, I loved being. You cannot imagine the, you have to. You never know. I thought it would be, of course, you just do whatever. On the other hand, she says it's better. Don't believe them when they. Pregnancy is not, you know. The baby will make you. Sometimes you will want to. You're always gonna need. You won't be able to. It's crazy, but.
The poetry of Emily Moan Slate. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thanks, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.